spend 8 weeks on this passage. And in fact, John Piper has spent like 12 weeks on this passage. So there are people who go into great detail and spend a long time. That's not bad. But my goal this morning is to kind of give you a big picture of what Paul is doing in this this section, and then give you some categories for you to go and do some more research on if you want. And in light of that, why I say that too is because we're going to touch on, I think, the most hot button topic of evangelical Christianity in our day. And I'm only going to give you like a 15-20 minute exposition on that. I'm not going to be able to answer every question. I'm not going to deal with every issue. I'm just going to deal with the big picture issues, and at the very end, if there are questions, I will definitely have a question and answer time with you that we can deal and talk through some of those things. And that particular hot button issue is homosexuality. Homosexuality is the issue today that overwhelmingly we are seeing people jump from a traditional Christian understanding of monogamous heterosexual and jumping over the chasm to saying you can now be a Christian and be homosexual. There are famous women, Rachel Held Evans, there are famous men, Matthew Vines, there are all kinds of Christians out there that are making this leap out of traditional heterosexual marriage into homosexual marriage. And what should we do as a result? I think the Christian church does two things overwhelmingly all the time. Number one, they harden their position against it. Does that make sense? And so then they just treat everyone who jumps over as idiots and enemies, and I hate you. Or the other side of the issue is that if we don't harden ourselves to it, we just softly become numb to it, and we're just like, well, maybe it's okay. And I don't want us to necessarily, just because of the culture and what people are saying, have that influence the way we think. I want actually the scripture to actually influence us. And so that's what we want to do today, is talk about God's wrath being revealed and how that is actually happening and why that is wrath. So let's pray. Jesus, we need your help because we're dealing with tough issues that deal with our culture, and maybe even more importantly, we're going to deal with broader issues that deal with our own hearts. And so God, help us not to look out there. Help us look in our own hearts. Help us look as a church, that we'd be people who are looking to Jesus and needing your Spirit to help us live this life you're calling us. And so we'll give you praise for what you'll do through us this morning in Jesus' name. Amen. So Romans 1, 23, all the way down to verse 32. Let me give you the structure and how Paul lays it out, because I think it'll become very important, and then we'll go back and walk our way through that structure. Here is what Paul does. Three times, he has a three-part structure. So if you noticed, there's lots of things that are repeated three times. God gave them over, God gave them over, God gave them over. They exchange, they exchange, they exchange. And here's why. Paul is doing a three-part structure, with each structure having three parts. Let me just show you a couple of what I'm talking about. Look in verse 23. The very first part of the first structure in verse 23 is they exchange the glory of the immortal God for images. So here is mankind's response when God reveals himself. What does man do? They reject God, right? So consequently, when they reject God, God's response is, you go on to verse 23, verse 24, then God handed them over. This is God's response. He hands people over to sin. And then you have this back and forth. Man rejects God, God hands them over, and then consequently man lives out his life in a certain way with certain actions. And this third part of the first structure here is this is how man lives. They now dishonor their bodies among themselves. You go down to verse 25, and Paul says this, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. Here is going back to the first part. They refuse to acknowledge the beauty of God and trust him. And so what does God do? He hands them over. And then mankind lives out a certain way because they've been handed over. And in the second set, this is the unnatural relations. This is the homosexual activity that is going on. And the third structure begins in verse 28. The third one says, and they did not see fit to acknowledge God. They refused him. And so verse 28b, God gave them over to a debased mind. And now, here is mankind's activity. There is a 21 adjective list of adjectives describing humanity's experience. What you see in each one of these three structures is that when you go from 1, 2 to 3, you get a deepening and a worsening and a more holistic picture on God's wrath on humanity. So why does Paul do it 3 times? Because he wants you to get a full picture, a deep picture, a wide picture of what is going on in the world. I began last week asking the question, how do we make sense of everything that's going on out there? And I want you to know that the answer that Paul gives you is we make sense of it because this is actually God's wrath on humanity. So let's jump in. Does that make sense? This is what Paul's doing. Let's jump in and begin to unpack a little bit more of what he's dealing with. So if you go all the way back, please, to verse 23. The first thing that man does is they exchange the glory of the immortal God for images. What is that a picture of? Idolatry, right? We just say that, like that's what idolatry is? There is this recognition, as we saw last week, that there is this amazing, beautiful, wonderful Creator God whose eternal power and divine nature is clearly seen, and they know the beauty of this God, the power of this God, and they refuse to actually give Him glory. They're not going to say, God, I'm going to give you all of my life and show you to be beautiful and trust you with my life. In fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make something that resembles mortal man or images or birds or creeping things. You know what man does? They would rather build something out of a piece of wood that they know that the Creator God made and refuse to give worth to the Creator God and actually worship the thing they made. That is how sinful humanity actually is that at our core, according to Romans 8, we will have nothing to do with this God, that we would rather worship something we make ourselves. I mean, isn't that the epitome of idolatry? You recognize that you won't give worth to this God, and so you're going to build something yourself and say, that is awesome. Isn't that weird? And yet we do it all the time. This is the fundamental problem of humanity. You go back to the Old Testament world of the Canaanites, when Israel was constantly being bombarded by all these outside cultures. And maybe the most famous deity, the most famous idol that Israel continued to worship over and over again was the god Baal, or Baal. You remember this little guy? Why I call him a little guy is this. Do you know what Baal was pictured as? A little tiny calf, like a little tiny cow. Okay, this seems so foreign to us, but just because it's not our culture. But people would actually take a piece of wood or a piece of metal and fashion it into like this cow, this calf. And it was like your fifth grader brought home an art project. Okay, like this is how good they were. They weren't even like caring. They were just like, we have to make this kind of like cow thing. And they would bring it into the city, and all the people would go to this particular idol and bow down and give glory to Baal. Why would they do that? They did it not because they thought the image that they made was so beautiful, but they did it because they thought in actually worshiping that God would actually give them something they really wanted. Do you know what Baal was the god of in the ancient world? Agriculture. The god of rain. If you couldn't, I mean, just think of every grocery store closed down in Hampton Roads. You'd go to somewhere else. What if every grocery store closed? Where would you get food? Like your backyard, right? And right now we'd be like, we'll have crops for the next 15 years. It's been raining so much. But if you ever went through a dry spell and there's no crops growing, would you be tempted to actually go and worship Baal? To give glory to something else, to actually say, I'm not going to trust that the immortal God who created everything is going to give me everything I need. I'm going to go here. And this is what the essence of idolatry is, that you exchange the glory of God for something that is not glory. In fact, Romans chapter 3 says it this way, for you know the Romans road, for all have sinned and done what? Fall short. The verb in the Greek there, when we get there, is not fall short. It actually is the word lack. For all have sinned and lacked the glory of God. This is what sin is doing to us. It is, is causing us to be unable to recognize the beautiful, the glorious nature of God. This is why redemption, not the church, redemption in Jesus is so majestic, is that when Jesus enters into your life, you can actually see the beauty of God, the glory of God, and it encapsulates your life. That's why Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, the light of the gospel has shone into our hearts so that now we can see the glory of God in the face of Jesus. And so Paul is saying, here's what man is doing. They're refusing to give glory to show the worth of the immortal God, and so they will make things to give worth, to give worship to. So God's response to that is, God says, if that's what you're going to do, I'm going to show myself to you clearly, and you're going to reject me and you give worth to something else. I'm going to hand you over, and specifically first time, to the lust of their hearts, to impurity. God is saying this, if you're going to do that, I'm going to hand you over to all types of sexual sin. I'm going to hand you over to fornication. I'm going to hand you over to adultery. I'm going to hand you over to pornography. I'm going to hand you over to every type of sexual sin that is out there. God says, this is what I'm going to do to you. I'm going to show my judgment upon you. I'm going to show my wrath upon you and cause you to live in these ways. If you're like me, when I began reading through this and began seeing that this is God's activity upon humanity, the question I asked over and over again is, how is that God's judgment, right? How is that judgment to hand people over to immorality, to sexual immorality, to adultery, to pornography? How does that God's activity, God's judgments? Well, hold on to that. I'm going to answer that as we keep going. But I tell you that question up front because I want you to keep seeing that this is God's judgments. In Rome, at that time, Rome was a city filled with immorality. Rome was a city filled with sexual morality. I mean, most of us in America, if you're a little bit older, like me and older, and you look at America, we're in a tizzy over what's happening in our culture, right? I mean, we're getting worse and worse, and we're getting so far away from our Christian principles, and the Ten Commandments can't be posted anymore, and we're not Jews, so that's what, I'm just kidding. And so, like we get all these, like, craziness going on. And one of the main things we see in our culture that we get so upset about is like all of the sexual perversion and immorality that's happening, right? Well, I'm not, trust me, I'm in no way like glorifying and saying it's good. But maybe we should step back and say, this is actually the wrath of God being revealed upon a group of people who refuse to acknowledge his worth. That will make sense of the story, won't it? Now we're not going to have to go and be like, how are we going to fix it? Oh, I got to get into politics. I got to do this. I got to join that club. I got to go here. We can actually just sit back and say, this is God's wrath. Like the church in Rome was wondering, why in the world is there so much immorality? And Paul is answering, it's because this is God's wrath upon humanity because they refuse to answer it. And so what is the result of that? Verse 24, here's what the human reaction is. They continue to dishonor their bodies among themselves. God says, I'm going to hand you over to it. And so this is what humanity runs to. Humanity is throughout all of history. You go back to the very early ancient Near Eastern cultures, you know what they were filled with? Sexual morality. You go to Corinth today, and we think sexuality and perversion is bad here, but like right across the street in Corinth, if we were there, you know, 2,000 years ago, we would actually see open temple prostitution. There'd be people having sexual intercourse right across the street in public. Have you seen that this week? So we're not quite there. We may get there, I don't know. But my point is that throughout all of the human history, sex and sexual immorality has been God's judgment upon civilization and societies and cultures. So I don't think we should be so surprised that as a group of people, we are abandoning the belief in the immortal God and worshiping other things, that God would hand us over this as part of judgments. Paul then, in the second section, begins to deepen and widen this picture. And he says in verse 25, because they exchanged the truth about God for, and I know the ESV that has a there, the word a, the article, the Greek actually has the definite article, the. They believed the lie. What do you think Paul is referring to here? In one sense, it is all of humanity. But in another sense, it is specifically a reference to Adam and Eve in my mind. They, Adam and Eve, exchanged the truth about God for the lie. And ever since then, this is what humanity has been doing. We've refused to believe truth and always believe the lie. What is the lie? When you go back to Genesis chapter 3, God had provided Adam and Eve everything they needed. And he was saying, here is the good life. The good life is you ruling and subduing and filling and eating from every tree in the garden, enjoying all of creation. Just stay away from that one tree because this is where the good life is found. And the serpent entered into the garden and he challenged the good life. He challenged what Adam and Eve thought would bring them happiness. And he offered them the ability to be like God, the ability to determine for themselves what is right and wrong. The serpent was basically saying, you know, God gave you all these rules of what is right and wrong and what is good life. Wouldn't you like that power? How many of you like that power of choosing what's right and wrong for yourself? You kind of do it every day of your life, even though you're Christians. And Adam believed the lie that the good life was to be found and the ability to determine for himself what is right and wrong. And so this is what humanity is doing. And consequently, when you believe the good life is found in something or someone else other than God, the Bible calls that also idolatry. If you're going to put your trust in the good life in a family, in a job, a spouse, a house, a car, that is believing the lie. Believing the lie is saying the good life is something other than what God has provided for me in and through Jesus. The good life is found in somewhere else and other than loving God supremely, which is demonstrated in loving your neighbor. The good life, the Bible tells you, is found in sacrificing and giving up your life for the sake of others. And that's not the good life that's presented to us. We believe the lie that Satan is offering us, and we begin to worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. So Paul, again, is just highlighting man's rejection of God. It's another demonstration of idolatry, of loving something more than God. And when you refuse to love God and love His truth, he then says this, for this reason, God's response is, He gave them over to dishonorable passions. These dishonorable passions are women abandoning natural relations with women, or with men for other women, and they are men abandoning natural relations with women for other men. We call this in our day homosexuality. Let me caveat a few things, make a few exegetical points, and do some concluding remarks, okay? Because I'm in no way going to be able to answer everything about homosexuality this morning. But let me just say a couple things as we jump in. Number one, I think as a Christian culture, we need to do some more homework about homosexuality, why people are believing that it's okay, begin to analyze what they're thinking and how they're doing. I think we need to do some more homework in our head of not just looking at the Bible and saying you're wrong. They are, but actually be able to show why. And number two, I think we need to do a better job of not just in the book, but out on the street, loving homosexuals better than we do. I think in many ways we treat them as like the outsider that if I have to deal with them, it's okay. Like, you go to a store and you meet a homosexual and your first thought is what? Ugh. Do I have to talk with you? Leave me alone. And I think we need to do a better job in our church, in our city, in our world, of actually coming alongside and actually listening to these people, loving them, and actually treating them like humans. Okay? Now, I know 1 Corinthians 5, people are thinking, if someone claims to be a Christian and lives contrary to that, do I still have to come alongside them and love them? You don't have to come alongside them, you have to love them. Does that make sense? Like, I know if you don't know what I'm talking about, you read 1 Corinthians 5 and we'll talk later, but my point is that at no point is there a lack of love for these people. The love might be you removing your presence from them, the church removing their presence from them. That might be the loving thing to do, but it's love that is motivating your activity for these people. So, what are they saying? Like, I've had this discussion with not just homosexuals, but with Christians who believe homosexuality is comparable and complementary to, you know, being a Christian. And they'll take me to Leviticus 18 and 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and they like, you know, they're like, Leviticus 18, that was just for the Jews. That's not for us. And 1 Corinthians 5, you know, if you're familiar with that argument, they're like, you know, that word could be translated this way, it could be translated that way. We don't know exactly what that word means. And so we spend like, I used to do this, and I'm like, okay, stop. Let's just go to Romans chapter 1. Why? Because Romans chapter 1 is like the clearest expression of the Bible's judgment against homosexuality. Does that make sense? And so we're here, in my mind, at the clearest demonstration of why homosexuality is not complementary, not relatable, not being able to be compatible with Christianity. And so when I talk to these people, it used to be crickets. Be like, let me go and do some research. But there have been some Christians recently who have done a lot of homework on this and have come up with some, I want to say, creative interpretations for Romans chapter 1. The way they get around Romans chapter 1, let me just give you two main arguments. These are not the only arguments. These are the big ones. And the first argument is what is natural. If you see in Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 26, this word nature and natural keeps showing up. Women exchange natural relations for those that are contrary to nature, and the men gave up natural relations. And so they use this argument of nature, and they come and they use this as their presupposition. What Paul is condemning is heterosexual people who then go against their nature and commit homosexual acts. Are you with me? So what they're saying is like their nature, first and foremost, if it's homosexual and they go and commit homosexual acts, that's not what Paul's condemning. He's condemning the heterosexual who that is their orientation and their nature, and they go and then commit homosexual acts. You with me on that? I'm not saying you have to agree. I just want you to understand the argument. Okay? It's the natural argument. The second argument that they're using predominantly is Paul is talking about promiscuous, unfaithful homosexual relations. He's not talking about monogamous homosexual relations. I've had many conversations with people recently where they're saying, well, if the homosexual couple is like monogamous and they love each other and they're committed to each other and they never get divorced, Paul isn't condemning that. Paul is just condemning the homosexuals. And if you think I'm crazy, the most famous book out there today that most people are reading and jumping over from traditional Christianity to progressive Christianity is a book called God and the Gay Christian by Matthew Vines. So if you're really interested in figuring out what their argumentation is, you can look Matthew Vines, God and the Gay Christian. And, well, since we're on the topic, I may forget to come back to it. If you want, like, people who rebuttal him and actually give some sound exegetical evidence, there's couple books I'd recommend if you're writing these down. If I'll give them to you later too. The first one is from a Pittsburgh Theological Seminary professor named Robert Gagnon. This is a 500-page book, just so you know. It's like detailed and argue, like, if you're really want to get in the weeds on this, that would be the number one book I would tell you. If you don't want to read the book, just do this: Google Justin Gagnon articles. It's so much easier. I've read like 30 articles by Justin Gagnon. I feel like I've got his whole book, but I've just done it in different pieces. Does that make sense? So you can find it in smaller bits. And then if you really want, we had a class a few years ago on sexual identity, and we have a book here called Love Into Light. We have a few more copies of this. This is a little bit smaller, more accessible work that is also good. If you want some of those, just come get me. Okay? But again, the two arguments are the natural argument and the monogamous argument. What do we say to that? Well, we could say all kinds of things. Let me just give you two. First of all, jump down to verse 27. In verse 27, Paul says this, "The men abandoned the natural function of women and burned in their desire towards one another." Look at that last phrase, "they burned in desire toward one another." Now, if these men who are by nature heterosexual and were going against their natural desire, what is the meaning of "they burned in their desire toward one another"? Okay, heterosexuals don't burn in their desire for homosexual relations. Only the people who burn towards unnatural relations are the homosexual people. So it doesn't even make any sense in my mind, just on that phrase, burn towards one another, had this inflamed aspect towards their relationship and attractiveness. That doesn't even make sense of the natural argument to me. Okay, and you can read hundreds more pages on that. Secondly, I think Paul is making a blanket statement that all homosexuality is wrong. And I get that from the verse 26 when he's talking about the women. At the end of verse 26, he says, "Women exchange natural relations for those that are," and in the Greek it's just one word, but in English it's "contrary to nature." Contrary to nature there is a very famous Greek expression that you could go read, if you don't know these people, it's fine. Josephus, Philo, these are like Jewish historians of the first century, use this exact same phrase. Other outside Greek writers use this exact same phrase. And every time that this word is used outside the Bible, it's always in reference to homosexual behavior of any and all kinds. What Paul is actually saying is that it doesn't matter if it's monogamous, it doesn't matter if it's this or that, it doesn't matter if it's natural or unnatural. What Paul is saying is that this, contrary to nature, is abandoning the natural use of man for woman and woman for man for each other. And so let's talk about the natural argument for a second. What is nature? What is natural? Well, if you've noticed here, and I've done a poor job on purpose, but Paul keeps going back to which Bible passage in the Old Testament in this book? I've done a little bit. He keeps going back to Genesis, right? I mean, if you see in Romans, I mentioned earlier, they exchanged the glory of God for images resembling what? Mortal man, birds, animals, creeping things. That's an exact quote from Genesis chapter 1. He talks about the lie, Genesis chapter 3, and Adam and Eve, and the idolatry that happened there. And he's constantly going back to Genesis 1 and 2 and 3. And here's why. Because Paul is grounding his arguments that what is natural is what was pre-fall, not what was post-fall. What is natural is what God made us to be and we are designed to be. When Adam and Eve sinned, guess what happened to our nature? It was corrupted and it was ruined. Every aspect of it was corrupted and ruined. And I want to ask this question. Do we really want to trust that our nature, when we are born, is what we should bank our life on because of Adam and Eve's curse? I don't think you want to. It'd be silly to say that the natural argument is what we are born into. The natural argument should be, what was God's original design for humanity? That is what is nature. That is what is natural. And Paul is grounding his polemic, his argument against homosexuality, based on the fact that at creation, God created a perfect partner for Adam, who was Eve. And God created the very first wedding. You get the imagery that God walked Eve down the aisle and turned around and married Adam and Eve and said, here is the picture of what marriage is. So Paul is grounding his understanding of why homosexual activity is wrong in any and all forms because of the nature that we were given at creation. And that is being redeemed in and through Jesus today by his Spirit. So let me close with close our discussion on homosexuality with a couple, just I think, applicational points, if you will. And I have so many that we'll just do a couple here. Number one, the argument that you were born a homosexual, have we heard this discussion before? The research I have done, you can find people saying anything they want to say. They can prove anything they want to say. I've read Christians who are saying it is nothing to do with genetics. There's no biological aspect to it. And then you read other people who are like, it's deeply in our hereditary. It's deeply in our genes. Does that make sense? Like, I read both sides. And how do you deal with that? Well, I deal with it this way. Because of our post-fall nature is so corrupt, we are all born with certain proclivities and propensities to do sin, correct? And then based on the environment and the nurture in which we grow up, those propensities and those proclivities begin to show themselves. So if you are a person who is chronically lying, like you just can't stop lying, you're like, I just lied again, like I can't, like you were probably born with that propensity. And then all of the environmental things that you were, you know, around and your upbringing and your parents and all of these other factors in your life have just brought that to the fore. Does that make sense? Or you're committed, you know, like to immorality or to pornography or to stealing. Like this is what it is to be a human, is to actually have a corrupt nature that is born. And then with all the environmental factors and nurture that we have, we are nurtured into more and more sin. And so I would say that's true for the homosexual person as well. That a person, and you can do all the research on this if you want as well, but the person who doesn't have a dad is far more, and an absent dad is far more prone to become a homosexual than other people. Like you can do all this research, but what I'm saying is that no matter where you're at in the story, God is calling the adulterer to stop adulterating. God is calling the liar to stop lying. And God is calling the person who has homosexual tendencies to do what? Stop committing homosexual acts. So that's what I want to say about, you know, born with it. We're all born the proclivities to sin. And we can't treat people who have proclivities to homosexuality as less than human. You with me? We can't. And those of you that have homosexual tendencies in this room, there is so much hope for you. There's hope in this life, and there's far more hope in the next life. There's so many stories of people like Rosaria Butterfield. Anyone familiar with her name? If you want to read a real-life story of a woman who was at the forefront of the LGBT movement, who became a Christian and is now married, Rosaria Butterfield has a great story of redemption, and she is offering her story for all Christians and all people to believe and to hear. We had a man here a year and a half ago from Kyleo from Philadelphia, and I remember him. He is doing the same thing. He's about to come out with a book telling his story of how God is redeeming his homosexual tendencies because of his upbringing and his backgrounds. And if you are a homosexual, or if you're a heterosexual, I don't care either way. One of the things that we have a problem doing is we define ourselves and other people by that term. It becomes your identity. And I want to tell you, church, today, that your identity is not homosexual. Your identity is not heterosexual. Your identity is what? What? Say it out. I want to hear all these. What are they? Jesus is our identity. What else? I'm a child of the Most High God. Isn't that so much better to identify your life with than that you're a heterosexual or homosexual? Like, and we begin to identify other people that way. And Paul is actually saying, no, that might be what they do and they commit, and for unbelievers, that's God's wrath upon society. But don't define yourself that way. You're already in a losing battle. Define yourself with who you really are in Jesus. Define yourself because that there's one who gave himself for you. So Paul, I think, is clearly saying that all homosexual activity is God's judgment upon a society for their rejection of who he is. And fundamentally, all sin, all evil, all sexual morality, all homosexuality is rooted where? In idolatry. Do you see that in this argument over and over and over again? That if you want to change your homosexual activity, if you want to change your sexual immorality, where do you have to change? At the level of who you worship, what you trust, and who you believe. Two things that have ruined societies from the very beginning. If you look at the history of civilization, two things have always ruined societies. Number one, it's sex, and the other one is what? Violence. You ever heard these two put together? Sex and violence. And we often think of violence only like in punching and shooting each other out, like, you know, if we watch a movie, was there a lot of violence in that? You know, and we're like, oh, I don't know, you know. You know what movie has a lot of violence in it? What's the latest? I keep using this example, but it's just the only one I can think of right now, okay, because I didn't write this down. This is coming to me right now. Is Runaway Bride. That movie has a lot of violence in it. Do you believe me on that? You're like, what? Let me explain. The third thing, the third category that Paul does, and as he closes out his argument, is in verse 28. Is they did not see fit to acknowledge God. This word acknowledge has this idea of like giving worth, approving, showing the genuineness of. They refused to give God his due, his worth. Why is that important? Because God's judgment over on them is he gave them up, and the ESV says debased, but the word is the exact same word in the Greek, but the opposite. He gave them up to a worthless mind. Like Paul's doing a wordplay here. They don't seem to give God his worth, and so God is going to make them worthless. Isn't that interesting? God's going to make you nothing when you try to do that. Even though you claim to be wise, God is going to make you worthless and turn you and make you a fool. You see that in verse 22? Claiming to be wise, God made them to be foolish. How many of you claim to be wise and God is making you look foolish? What I mean by that is this. How many of you are like able to justify your sin to the infinite degree? That's you being like, I'm so wise. I know how to get around this. I know how to get, you know, go that far, and I can go here and do this, and, you know, it's not that bad, and we have, like, become wise in our minds. And all that is a picture that you are actually a fool, that God has handed you over to worthlessness. Like, we claim to be wise. We don't, I mean, you probably don't talk to your neighbor, your wife, your child, and be like, I'm so wise today. Look at how I got around this sin. Right? But in your heart, you know you're so wise. And so Paul is saying, here's what's actually happening. God, if you're not going to give him his worth, he's going to make you become worthless and turn you into a fool and show you ultimately that the way that you think is not going to give you life and vitality and meaning. Because the activity that God does is when he hands people over to a worthless mind, sorry, the activity that people do, is that now I want to say that this long description of 21 adjectives is a list of violence. It's a list of humanity attacking other humans. All sin is not just sin against God, but sin is also sin against one another. That when you lie to someone, you are doing violence to that person. When you steal something from someone, you're actually committing a violent act against that person. Even though you didn't touch them or shoot them or take a Nerf gun like my kids and kill me. Like the point is that violence is any activity that is wrongful intent towards other humans. And this 21 list, adjective list, sorry, is filled with humanity committing violence against each other. They're filled with evil, covetousness, malice, envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They're gossips, slanderers. They hate God. They're insolent. They're haughty. They're boastful. They invent ways to do evil. Teens, hear me. They're disobedient to their parents. Your disobedience, teens, hear me, is not because it's a cultural thing to do in America. Like, we have this tendency as teenagers to think, hey, you know, it's just normal for teenagers to rebel and not listen to their parents and think they're idiots. That's normal. You know why it's normal? Because it's God's judgment upon a society. They're foolish, they're faithless, they're heartless, they're ruthless. Do you find yourself in there anywhere? You probably do, right? I mean, if you're a human, you look at that long list and you're like, wow. And he's like all over the map. Does that make sense? It's like haters of God to like internal attitudes of like gossips, and that's external, but of malice to gossip all the way to murder. Like, he's everywhere on this page. Because here's why this is wrath. Every society is looking for meaning and purpose and happiness. And the essence of this is that if that society and that people and that culture is not built fundamentally on giving God his worth and giving God his glory and giving God his due, God is going to say, I'm going to turn your civilization upside down. And sex and violence have ruined societies forever. And you know what's ruining America? And it's not because I'm this American patriot that I think America is the new kingdom of God. No, it's because the judgment of God is being revealed to us. Because we refuse to give him our worth, give him his worth, his due. And so he hands people over to sin, into more sin, which creates more unrest and creates more havoc and more chaos and more unrest in a society. That is God's wrath upon the world because of their insolence. Maybe the most important thing I can tell you this morning is, like, you know what? I'm there. Everything you described to me, I'm guilty of. Here's our hope. In verse 32, Paul ends his entire argument this way. This is what Paul is getting to. It's like the summary statement of his opening argument. He says this, though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they what? Give approval. So these are people who aren't just saying, yeah, that's me, but they're saying, you should come do this with me. That's okay if you do that. I think here's the dividing line, a dividing line, between a Christian and a non-Christian. Are you telling other people that it's okay to do all those things? I think if you are, it's a pretty clear mark that this is God's wrath upon you. And how do we escape that wrath? This is one of the problems of going verse by verse. The good news is coming. It's just like many verses later. The good news is that in Romans chapter 3, verses 26 to the end of the chapter, Paul says this, that someone took away your wrath. The wrath of God is being revealed against all unrighteousness and ungodliness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth, and yet there is one who came to take your wrath. So that even though you might find yourself in that list somewhere, you're not under God's wrath because you're not approving of it. You're fighting against it. You don't want that. Because you see the beauty and the worth of the one who took away your wrath. So look to him. Turn to the one who took away your wrath. Jesus, thank you for a few minutes to think through some hard, difficult concepts. I pray that you would give us eyes to see and ears to hear and hearts to believe the scripture this morning. And we ask these things in Jesus' name.